A cricket covered in its own blood and guts is in danger of getting eaten by its own kind. This moment of science comes from Indiana University, with production support from the Office of the Provost. Today's program was prepared by Jeremy Shear, with help from Larry Murdoch at Purdue University. There are hundreds more moments of science on our website at amomentofscience.org. I'm Don Glass.
Support for WILL comes from the Champaign County Humane Society, promoting animal welfare since 1951. Pet adoptions are available from the Humane Society, a member of Community Shares of Illinois, a choice for payroll donation at work, on the web at cs-il.org.
In sports, the city of Denver gets to bask in the spotlight of NFL Monday Night Football this evening. The 6-1 Broncos are playing host to the 5-2 Steelers. The Broncos were beaten by the Ravens last Sunday while the Steelers had the week off. Tommy West has been fired as football coach at Memphis. The Tigers are 2-7 this season, fresh off a 56-28 loss to in-state rival Tennessee. Isaiah Thomas makes his debut as a head coach in college basketball tonight. His Florida International team is playing sixth-ranked North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Number 23 Illinois will open its season on a good note. Illinois defeated Quincy 84-63 in a men's basketball exhibition game in Champaign yesterday. The Illini season starts Friday against SIU Edwardsville. And the Chicago Blackhawks are hoping to rebound from a pair of road defeats when they open a four-game homestand tonight against the Los Angeles Kings. There's a chance they will get help from Captain Jonathan Toews coming back from injury. That's sports.
I'm Susan Hopkins. When we had little kids and a mortgage, we made small gifts to WILL. Then a friend mentioned that WILL was so important to him, he thought it was worth a dollar a day. I thought, wow. His advocacy for WILL has stayed in my mind. Recently, we found a creative way to give to the endowment fund using non-cash assets. I invite you to think creatively about giving, too, when the time is right, for you.
I'm Donda Beard at WILL. For more information, call 217-333-9393.
It's 2:43. We've been hearing a lot about financial scandals in the past year. This report reminds us that these cases linger for years in the courts. You'll recall the energy trading company Enron, which went bankrupt in 2000, won and wiped out $16 billion worth of Enron stock, decimated employee pensions, and eliminated thousands of jobs in Houston. Enron CEO Jeffrey Skilling was convicted of multiple crimes and sentenced to 24 years in federal prison. The U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to hear his appeal. NPR's Wade Goodwin brings us up to date.
Sitting in a federal prison on the cold plains of Waseca, Minnesota, is a nearly forgotten man. He helped give birth to an entirely new industry, trading natural gas futures. Jeff Skilling was the real brains behind the magnificent success story called Enron. His fall from grace was just as spectacular, becoming one of the most despised men in Houston history, which is saying something. And now, after being consigned to the dustbin, Skilling could be posed to make his curtain call as the victim of a federal prosecution gone astray.
I mean, I think there will be a lot of people who will be angry if the Supreme Court reverses this decision.
Lauren Steffi is the business columnist for the Houston Chronicle who's been covering the Enron prosecutions. He doesn't believe the U.S. Supreme Court should let Skilling walk, but he thinks there's a chance Skilling might.
Usually when the Supreme Court takes a case like this, it usually winds up in some sort of a reversal.
There are two questions the court has agreed to consider. The first, should the judge have granted Skilling's request for a change of venue? Daniel Petricelli is Skilling's lawyer.
The problem with the jury pool in Houston was that you could barely find a single individual anywhere who had not himself or herself suffered economic calamity.
Before the trial, Petricelli pleaded with U.S. District Judge Sim Lake to move the proceedings out of Houston to Phoenix or Atlanta. He argued that the entire city felt duped after Enron imploded.
You cannot have the victims of a crime sitting in judgment of the defendant.
But change of venue is just the first shot in Petricelli's arsenal. The second round concerns a federal statute that was at the heart of the government's case against Jeff Skilling. namely that the Enron CEO deprived the company's employees and shareholders of what federal law calls his honest services.
A scheme to deprive another of the intangible right of honest services. And that's just a quote from the statute. The question is, what the heck does that mean?
Susan Klein teaches law at the University of Texas Law School. Klein says the honest services statute was originally designed to convict public officials who were lining their pockets. But as Wall Street corruption became higher profile during the last decade, prosecutors began to look for additional ways to charge those executives. Deprivation of honest services became that tool, giving the government the opportunity to introduce a broader range of evidence. It was a concept that was simple for juries to understand, and it had the benefit of being just vague enough to allow prosecutors to apply it to a number of allegedly dishonest and illegal acts.
I mean, I think that's what the prosecutors would like. They'd like it to be whatever they charge it to be, and they can convince 12 jurors that it should be. But a lot of circuit courts are very troubled by that.
But federal prosecutors reply that the proof is in the conviction pudding. When prosecutors present evidence of repeated deceptions by a company's top officers, juries seem happy to convict of honest services fraud. Jacob Frankel is a former federal prosecutor and an SEC enforcement lawyer.
This is the law that has been used to prosecute them and prosecute them successfully. Given the broad range of fraud with respect to corporate boardrooms, government prosecutors saw an opportunity to enhance their arsenal with the expansion of the honest services fraud doctrine.
The federal appeals courts have upheld some honest services convictions and thrown out others, with the appeals courts pointing in both directions like the Scarecrow and the Wizard of Oz. The question is ripe for the nation's highest court. But University of Texas law professor Susan Klein predicts that the Supreme Court is not going to gut the honest services statute entirely.
I don't think it's going to happen. It wouldn't be just these cases that would be reversed. They're basically saying honest services isn't really a crime. Well, what do we do with all those people who have been convicted and who are now in prison serving sentences for honest services mail fraud? They were convicted of something that isn't a crime.
For those who want to see Jeff Skilling spend the balance of his life in prison, and there are many in Texas, the Supreme Court's decision to take the Skilling appeal is ominous. If the court rules that Skilling should have been granted a change of venue, his convictions would be thrown out. A reversal on the honest services statute might result in a majority of the convictions being tossed. For Jeff Skilling, the Supreme Court's decision is sweet hope that he won't have to spend the rest of his life in Waseca, Minnesota. Wade Goodwin, NPR News, Dallas.
It's called the economic engine of the South. Atlanta, Georgia's population has exploded in the last two decades, but with that growth has come environmental problems. One problem, how to get enough drinking water. Georgia, Florida, and Alabama have been fighting over who gets how much water from rivers that flow through the states. Tanya Ott reports a decision in the federal lawsuit could affect communities across the country.
Atlanta draws millions of gallons of drinking water each day from nearby Lake Lanier. But Alabama and Florida say it's such a water hog, there might not be enough water sent on downstream to cool power plants or protect the seafood industry.
And I had no idea. I didn't really, realize there was a problem.
Atlanta area resident Connie Brand says she knew the state was in a drought last year. She knew she was supposed to conserve water, and she did.
Not taking such a long shower, not doing small loads of laundry.
But only recently did she realize how big a problem this could be. In July, federal judge Paul Magnuson ruled that under the law, Lake Lanier was intended only for things like navigation and flood control, not drinking water. He said if Florida, Georgia, and Alabama don't come to a water agreement by 2012, Atlanta has to stop taking drinking water from Lake Lanier.
The action of a court could create a public health emergency that would probably rival the effects of Katrina.
That's Charles Krautler. He's director of the Atlanta Regional Commission. He says in the past 25 years, Atlanta's population has more than doubled to 4 million residents, and there's no way to get water to people without Lake Lanier.
How do you decide who doesn't have water and who does? Our chairman likes to say FEMA doesn't have enough trucks to bring in enough bottled water to deal with the shortfall that would exist.
It's not just an issue for Atlanta. There are more than two dozen similar reservoirs around the country. They were built for navigation, flood control, and hydropower. But communities are using them for drinking water. Congress might have to step in to basically retroactively approve the drinking water use. Cindy Lowry is executive director of the Alabama Rivers Alliance.
If it goes to Congress, which the court case says that it might have to, it could get even more political and more chaotic, really.
Several members of Congress have said they won't act until Florida, Georgia, and Alabama come to a deal. But Lowry says so far the negotiations have been dominated by government agencies and special interests like power companies. She wants a panel of neutral advisors and scientists to study the issue. In the meantime, Atlanta residents like Connie Brand are left wondering what will happen.
Oh, I'm from a family who grew up where they relied on cistern water, which when it rained, you had water, and when it didn't rain, you didn't have water. So I'm familiar with having to ration and be careful about those things, but I don't think that my child or people of my generation, their children, have any concept of conservation of water or anything like that.
Brand says she might just have to step up her own conservation efforts.
What was it we had in college? If it's yellow, let it mellow. If it's brown, flush it down. That'll be our new motto.
For the Environment Report, I'm Tanya Ott.
Support for the Environment Report comes from the Park Foundation and the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation. You can hear the report and subscribe to the daily podcast at environmentreport.org.
The hotel industry has been hammered in this recession, but one part of the industry has seen a building boom. Big hotel chains like Hyatt, Marriott, and Starwood are rolling out lines of specialty hotels. Kurt Nickisch of member station WBUR in Boston sends this report from one such hotel that opened there.
What you and I think of the lobby, the new W Boston Hotel calls its living room, plunked down in one of the leather pods, and you can admire the polished granite floors by leaning back and seeing them reflected in the mirror on the ceiling. In the evening, the staff turns the lights down and the music up. W is part of a big hotel company called Starwood. This new location is the latest in a growing trend of so-called contemporary lifestyle hotels. Hyatt's line is called Andaz. Marriott has Edition. The idea is to lure customers bored of mainstream hotels. W's global brand manager, Eva Ziegler, takes her job very seriously.
We want to provide access to a world of wow. Basically help you to escape from the fears, from the mundaneness of everyday life, and come into a world where everything is possible.
That might sound attractive if you can afford it. The W's room rates in Boston start around $200. Hotel staffers wear designer outfits and no name tags because they're just as cool as you. They'll get you anything you want as long as it's legal. The hotel's general manager, Bill Bunce, remembers the customer who wanted a hot chocolate bath.
To get all of that ready and get it in the tub and marshmallows floating. And they wanted it hot, too, which is even more difficult to do. But we were able to do it.
And put it on the bill.
That's the other key part, too. They want to pay the price. You can tell me whatever you want. I can deliver it, but there'll be a price attached to it. So
it's a particularly difficult time to be opening up a luxury high-end hotel in an economy like we've had for the past year now.
Reed Woodworth is a hotel industry analyst at PKF Consulting. He says occupancy is down nationwide, even as hotels have been cutting rates. But Woodworth says hotel companies remember that before the recession, consumers were willing to pay about $80 more to stay in these newer, cooler hotels that don't feel like a chain, even though they are. The hotel companies are betting on that demand coming back. Here's Eva Ziegler.
W Hotels basically doesn't build hotels just today for tomorrow, but builds hotels for the long term. so that when the economy comes back, it also means we will own the upswing.
Industry analyst Reed Woodworth says investing in new locations during a downturn can keep customers loyal and interested, but it's risky.
It's still pretty much the wisdom in the hospitality world that this is going to be a rather slow climb out of this hole. So while they are riding the upswing, as it were, it still looks to be a very gradual upswing over the next few years.
Meaning it could be a long time before these hotels make money. After all, people have gotten used to paying low rates for high-end hotels. It's going to take a while to convince consumers to pay the high prices they used to pay for these kinds of hotels, even with the lure of hot chocolate in the bathtub. For NPR News, I'm Kurt Nickisch in Boston.
Noise pollution can be a problem anywhere, including in the apartment downstairs from one owned by a singing and dancing sensation. Commentator Amy Guida tells us about Madonna and her neighbor in this week's edition of Legal Issues in the News.
There are many things in life we should be thankful for. Take the fact that we don't live in the Manhattan apartment above the one owned by Madonna, the pop star also called the Material Girl. Turns out that you, girl, apparently need some better material for sound insulation. Now, it's true that we've only heard one side of the incessant pounding music story, and that would be the side of the involuntary insomniac who does live in the next apartment up. How bad can it be to have Madonna as the downstairs neighbor? As Madonna herself has admitted in song, it's only when she's dancing that she can feel this free, and at night she locks the doors where no one else can see. Trouble is that the door locks apparently can't keep the sounds of pop music from escaping, and sure enough, the Associated Press says Madonna's neighbor has complained about blurring music, stomping, and shaking walls. Thus, we have a neighborly tiff in Madonna's Manhattan Cooperative apartment building on Central Park. Just as there are noise ordinances in a neighborhood meant for those who like to party at midnight and let everyone else within several blocks know that they're partying at midnight, there are provisions in cooperative apartment contracts that help keep the noise at acceptable levels. In one case, the cooperative board forbade all, and I'm quoting here, disturbing noises, a provision that could lead to an interesting debate about Madonna's dance party sensation, Holiday. In the disturbing noises case, a Madonna's neighbor-like woman sued over, quote, the sounds of heavy walking, banging, and a washer and dryer emanating from the apartment above. In that case, the court wasn't particularly understanding of the downstairs neighbor's concerns and found no truly disturbing noises, noises that would be enough to create a constructive eviction, at least. As noisy as New York may be, that case and others show how much New Yorkers appreciate quiet. There's the cooperative board in New York that attempted to get rid of the man who liked to yell and scream in the common areas, or the woman who complained that